Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Well, the same thing is going on in Iran, that's going on in Venezuela to a lesser extent. The same policies, more or less, a de facto embargo in place on the country. The Trump people want to get Iranian oil exports. The U.S. wants to transform both countries into client states, so it controls. The main issue is getting rid of their sovereign independence and controlling their oil.
Ellen's guest today, Stephen Lendman, has been an observer of international politics and economies for many decades, and he brings valuable perspectives to the emergence and reemergence of the grand stratagems in today's current events that are driven, as usual, by powerful private and political interests. Today, Ellen and Stephen will discuss how profiteering by international political and money interests continue to challenge the national sovereignties of many nations. But we'll also contrast those developments with how similar corporate interests have been dealt with on a local basis by taking a look at the challenges to local control in North Dakota and how they've played out. Hello, and welcome once again to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Ellen's co-host and colleague at the Public Banking Institute, Walt McCree. In addition to hearing Ellen's conversation with Stephen Lendman, we'll return to another installment in the 100th anniversary retrospective of the Bank of North Dakota with Mike Jacobs, who is the historian and author of the centenary book about the Bank of North Dakota. We'll walk through some of that bank's historical threads and the ways in which local sentiment and bank policies help to preserve local control. Such comparisons reflect the larger, dominant systems of monetary control that drive economic outcomes, of course. If money is tight, economies shrink, and prospects for broader wealth are diminished, particularly among the working class, as they're put under intensified pressures. When money and credit are more available, economies get fired up, and prospects and moods tend to lift. So it's important to note that these macro policies and the systems that operate within them are in lockstep at key points. For example, in China, it could be said that citizens are doing much better overall economically than their counterparts in the United States, at least from some metrics of analysis. Homeownership is one such metric that has been a part of the fabled American dream. Yet we see that this dream has been shattered for millions of Americans by the bank-driven financial collapse of 2008, from which we're still recovering. But that's not the only metric worth considering, and Ellen has a new article out that contrasts this disparity. So let's talk to Ellen about her new article that contrasts this disparity. So, Ellen, your new article is called Why Can 90% of Chinese Families Afford Their Own Homes? You're kind of on dangerous grounds suggesting that another economic system might be more effective or even fair.
Right. Well, we had this trade war going with China, supposedly because they are engaging in unfair trade practices, and so we're penalizing them with tariffs. And among those unfair trade practices are said to be that they basically exploit their workers by paying them slave-like wages. But if that's true, why is it that, as it turns out, 90% of Chinese families are able to own their own homes compared to only less than 65% of U.S. families? And for U.S. families, we don't really own our homes outright. More than 50% of the equity in the homes is actually owned by the banks. Whereas for the Chinese, 80% of them own their homes outright. So 90% of Chinese own their own homes and 80% of those own them outright. So how is that possible when supposedly their wages are only 1/7 those in the United States? So that's what I was writing about. And the answer is, or my proposed answer is, that the Chinese government actually supports their people. They support their businesses, which is another thing we consider an unfair trade practice. What if we did the same thing? Maybe we would actually be as productive as they are. And they support their people with educational subsidies, transportation subsidies, and medical subsidies. Those are the leading ones. So they have a medical system that's similar to Canada's. Medical is like not a big issue for the people, whereas it is for us. And they support education so that you can, it's like the old days in the U.S. where you used to be able to work your way through with a part-time job and come out with no debt. So student debt's not a big problem for them. Hmm. Whereas for us, the average student debt now is $37,000 and it takes 20 years to pay that off. So 70% of Chinese millennials already own their own homes. And there's no way.
Well, 70% of their millennials,
which
amazing.
Is people we're, under 36. Yeah, whereas our millennials are lucky to be even making their payments on their student debt.
So. Yeah, and I was surprised, shocked really, to see that, as you say, 80% of the homes, the Chinese homes, are owned outright. They don't have mortgages. They haven't gone to the banks. They haven't doubled the cost of their investment. That's just unheard of.
And in China, on average, they go in with 50% down payment.
Amazing.
So, yeah.
And the other thing that you point out in the article is that over 20% of the people have second homes.
Yeah.
Stunning.
Yeah. Well, also one thing I didn't mention in that article, they don't have real estate taxes. So you can have these second homes and just own them. It's something, it's an asset you can own, just like holding gold or something where you're not getting rent on it or interest, but it's still worth it because you figure it's going to be an appreciating asset. So they tend to put their money into homes.
What you're illustrating is something that your new book, Banking on the People, what this illustrates about China is that a banking system can be built around, or at least an economic system can be built upon the stability of the lives of the people.
And then there's the question of how does the government manage to find the money to support medical, or transportation, education, et cetera? And the answer is they own 80% of their banks. Mm. So they're engaging in something called, that we has been called qualitative easing, or they call it quantitative easing with Chinese characteristics.
I see. Yeah.
So instead of using quantitative easing, money issued by the central bank to support the banks, which is what our QE was about. Mm-hmm. They are using it to support the people and to support local industry. So we say, oh, they're cheating. They're supporting their local industries. But what a great idea. Maybe we should support our local industries and we too could use our central bank to actually put real money into the economy, into the real economy where it's needed, where it'll get into the pockets of consumers and that stimulates mm-hmm. productivity. So it does seem to me that in some ways we might be better off copying the Chinese system than punishing it for being too good of a competitor with ours.
Yeah, interesting. I suppose we see some analogies to the Bank of North Dakota's history as well, that that their bank, owned by the people, was able to make, to adjust and to adapt to various unfavorable agricultural conditions and periods of great economic distress by doing things like having moratoriums on mortgage payments, by holding property even though the markets hadn't been there for years. That kind of flexibility of a people's bank is an enormous asset.
Right. And China's central bank is called the People's Bank of China, and it really does seem to be serving the people and serving local industry. Yeah, we could do the same, and we should do the same, it seems to me, support our industries. Or at least what our central bank could do is to make zero interest loans to state and local governments, which is, they did that for the banks, zero-interest loans, and that's how they propped up the banks. Our state and local governments are responsible for the infrastructure in their areas, and they don't have the money. We need a new source of money. The issue always is whether that would be inflationary, but I argue that it wouldn't, that we actually have to get more money into the system, and we need to get it there every year. Only 15% of loans are currently go to business. The other 85% go to the financialized economy in the U.S. So that's money that trickles up and it never comes back. It gets caught in that financialized casino, where that would include housing, but existing housing, where you're bidding on houses that have already been built. You're not building new houses. You're bidding on old houses, and just you're gambling that this asset is going to go up. Well, you plan to live in it, but or some do. I mean, much of that is absentee owners. Like BlackRock now owns, I think, more homes than anything else and any other entity, and they are renting them back to people at quite high rates. So it's all money making money, and that would include the stock market, where the money you put into stocks is not going to the business. It goes to the previous owner. So again, it's a big casino where you're playing the greater fool thing, where you're gambling that you will find somebody to buy it for more money than you paid for it. So if only 15% of credit is going to businesses, and businesses produce things that raise supply.
And jobs.
Yeah, so if you put more money into increasing real supply, then supply and demand rise together and prices remain stable. So in China, they have actually increased the money supply by 800%, a factor of 8 in the last 20 years. And still, the inflation rate is only 2%, which is what we're considering the goal of inflation is 2%. So why is that? Because their GDP has actually gone up more than 800%. So supply and demand again balance each other out.
Yeah, that whole matrix or system of debt that we're dependent on really ties our hands and our ability to stabilize and improve and build a real economy here in America. We're propping up all of the agencies and companies of debt financialization of our economy, and we're left with pretty sad prospects for many, and a deteriorating situation for assets. Well, your conversation with Stephen Lendman touches on this macro system of control, of monetary control over the sovereignty of nations. And so the outcomes and the threats that are underway are being driven by, by the same private interests that are preying on the American consumers and the American economy.
And other countries don't have the luxury we have of actually issuing their own money and borrowing in their own money. So you take Venezuela, for example. Or interestingly enough, Venezuela is not a member of the Bank for International Settlements. Neither was Libya, neither was Iraq, neither was Syria. North Korea, all those countries that we declared as
enemy states
are not part of the banking system, which under the BIS, you're central bank is supposed to be independent. It's not supposed to be working for the government. And in those countries, it is. So we, on the other hand, could actually be issuing our own money to be doing many things that we need, as the Chinese do. They don't even have to borrow from their central bank because they own 80% of ordinary banks. So they can just, if they need to build something, they just issue a loan to themselves. And if it pays off, great. And if it doesn't, it's just like in North Dakota. They don't shut down the bank and say, you're bankrupt. They just carry it as a non-performing loan. And we complain and we say, oh, it's terrible. China has all these non-performing loans. But they are their own non-performing loans. I mean, all they've done is issued credit that didn't get paid back. So there's no harm.
No loss.
You get some extra money into the economy, which you actually need.
Let's go talk to Stephen about what he has seen after all these decades. Thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thank you. I'm speaking with Stephen Lendman, a prolific writer and syndicated columnist who hosted a radio show on this network for many years until he had to stop due to health issues. He interviewed me many times on that show and is still very actively writing.
So great to be talking to you.
Yeah, it's great to be on. I was on PRN for a good many years, and I'm still doing my best every day, but my spirit is at its peak.
And your brain is sharp. I mean, you generate like articles every day, which is amazing. So you're really peering into what's going on the international front particularly, and we have a lot of interesting developments right now. We seem to have a populist revolution going on in Europe. You've written about the trade war with China and Iran and developments in Venezuela and Ecuador. I wondered if you'd give us a little rundown on what's happening there and how we're not really getting the true story in the MSM. You've written that the situation is similar to Chile in 1973, where U.S. blockades of supplies and trade crippled the economy. And, of course, the leader gets blamed, but we are to blame, unfortunately, or it looks that way. So do you want to talk about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the problem with Venezuela, Ellen, is, number one, its sovereign independence. It's a nation that the U.S. does not control. It's also a democratic nation. There aren't too many of those around. I think you have to really search far and wide to discover what countries really are democratic. It certainly is not very much the case when it comes to Western societies, especially the U.S. That's a different topic altogether. It's one I write about an awful lot. But Venezuela is very much democratic, social democratic. It also has the world's largest oil reserves, the prize that the U.S. covets. It's wanted that prize for a long time. It really had control over them. Big oil had control over them until Hugo Chavez was elected in December 1998, took office in February 1999, and then everything changed, and efforts have been to switch the state of Venezuela back to U.S. client state status ever since, and that's what going on now. And of course, Colombia and Venezuela share a common border, the same with Venezuela and Brazil. And the governments of Brazil and Colombia are very close U.S. allies.
Right. Well, I also saw that in Haiti there were riots because they weren't getting their oil supplements from Venezuela. The Bolivarian Revolution that Chavez was attempting to pull off would have created independence for the Latin American countries, independence from us. Of course, they're theoretically democratically independent, but they're not economically independent, and that's what he was trying to do. So he was giving cheap oil to different countries, including actually the U.S., until we rejected it, I guess. But anyway, so that the poor Haitians were supposed to get the benefit of this subsidy, and they weren't getting it because it had been cut off because of what the U.S. had done. Anyway, it has ramifications all across the whole Latin American, you know, among all those countries. So the Bolivarian Revolution involved, well, in Venezuela, there was a new constitution that was passed that mandated free education, health care, and other social benefits. And, of course, by putting up a blockade, we've impeded the ability for them to get medicines. And anyway, you wrote an article on that as well. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, indeed. I was writing at the beginning when Guaido self-declared himself president. I was writing daily articles on Venezuela. I'm still writing a good many on the country because this is an ongoing story. It's not going away anytime soon. It could be going on months from now. Who knows? We'll have to see what next steps the people in Washington will take. But indeed, there's a blockade without an officially declared blockade going on. The Trump people want vessels not bringing food into Venezuela, not bringing medical supplies. So, I mean, that really is a blockade without formally declaring it. And under international law, blockades are an act of war, which is exactly what the U.S. is waging against Venezuela. I call it a war by other means. Nobody's shooting anybody in the streets except, clashes between locals and the Venezuelan security forces, thugs that are attacking the government. A little bit of that went on April 30th when there was a sort of a coup attempt. Well, the whole thing has been a coup attempt, but there was a very weakly manufactured uprising that was put down in a matter of hours. It really was was something that was intended to fail, not succeed, because it had no chance to succeed. And almost a month ago this happened, and we'll see what happens after that. But Venezuela is really going through some hard times, even though the people are not starving. There's a food assistance program where, despite the high inflation, extraordinarily high inflation, the government is providing food, subsidized food, covering the vast majority of the cost for 6 million households, which is about two-thirds of the population. My math may be a little off on that, but the majority of the population, and President Maduro wants this increase to cover virtually any Venezuelan who wants this, who can't afford the price of food. Supermarkets are stocked with food and everything else. If you walked into a Venezuelan supermarket in one of the Caracas or another cities and walked up and down the aisles, they would look like a U.S. supermarket. But the prices are way beyond what ordinary Venezuelans can afford because of inflation. So the government counteracts against this by subsidizing food, making sure no Venezuelans are starving, even though media reports claim otherwise. It simply isn't true. But they're not getting the medicines that they need. There are Venezuelans that are dying because they simply don't have the medications that they need, not in big numbers, but affecting a good number of people. Things are not normal in the country because of the economic effects. Sanctions war, financial war going on against the country. And all of this is illegal, of course.
Yeah, and the inflation is blamed on the government, on the Venezuelan government, but really it's the result of currency manipulation. I mean, it's really us that are doing it, just like with the Zimbabwe inflation, where they were in debt in U.S. dollars. And or in, you know, foreign currencies, which they couldn't generate themselves, and they really had no choice but to print the money in order to get this money, and then speculators, of course, just drove the price of the value of the local currency down, and that's what's happening here too. So it all has to do with currency speculation on foreign markets. It's not that he's printing money wildly to do things internally, and if you do print money for public purposes, it actually stimulates the economy, and we have lots of cases to demonstrate that.
Well, the same thing is going on in Iran, that's going on in Venezuela to a lesser extent. The same policies, more or less, a de facto embargo in place on the country. The Trump people want to get Iranian oil exports, just like Venezuela, the main export is oil. In the case of Venezuela, it's something like 90 or 95% of Venezuelan exports, so it really is crucial to keep the oil flowing, and it's not flowing the way it should. And in the case of Iran, they have other exports related to oil, petrochemicals. They have a couple of other industries, and they're getting revenues from that. But there's a de facto embargo on the country to bring all its exports down to zero. The same objective against both countries. Inflation in Iran is also high, but nothing like Venezuela, maybe 40%, 50%, which is pretty damn high. And it's causing great duress for the people in the country. And again, all of this stuff is illegal. The U.S. wants to transform both countries into client states, so it controls the main issue is getting rid of their sovereign independence and controlling their oil. Oil is a big deal, and Henry Kissinger said it well, Ellen, you know this, and I've mentioned it a couple of times in my articles. If you control oil, you control nations, what Kissinger said. And if you control money, you control everything.
Yeah, but and I even wonder, I mean, oil is just sort of an excuse because we could buy the oil, you know, we could just buy it on the open market. It's not like it's difficult to get oil. It's because, like you say, we want to be in control. We want this full spectrum dominance over the whole world, basically. And it's not us. It's not we, the people. And I mean, it's really this whole neocon thing that has been going on for, 20 years now, I guess. And somehow they always manage to get in and to control the government.
Oh, indeed, at least through the post-9/11 era. And, I mean, just neocon heaven. And the neocons in Washington are on both sides of the aisle. There are plenty of people I call undemocratic Dems, Ellen, that are just as extreme on the right as most of the Republicans. It's not the kind of government that I remember growing up in as a boy that I remember a little bit during World War II in the 40s. But in the post-war era, I vaguely remember the end of the Roosevelt era. The Truman era, I remember very well, and the government's after that. There are no Eisenhower Republicans in Washington now. Whatever faults Eisenhower may have had, I can only dream about having somebody like Eisenhower as a U.S. president compared to what we have today. Whether it's a Dem or a Republican, it's all the same thing. Obama, Trump, Joe Biden, if he gets in, it's all the same thing. The Clinton co-presidency, which is what I called it, Obama, same, they're all the same. They do things a little differently from each other. It seems that every new U.S. administration is worse than the preceding one. It's been this way since the 1990s.
Well, the one sign of hope that I see, I mean, particularly with the Trump election, I mean, it really was a form of populist revolution. It was a protest vote against things as usual. And one thing about Trump, he certainly stirs things up. So it's an opportunity for us to arguably possibly change the monetary system, which is what money reformers have tried to do for the last 100 years, but they can't really seem to get a foot in the door. But now we have quite dangerous things going on, and we have a young people's revolution. They realize that they come into life with a raw deal. They don't have the benefits that we had when we were young. So they are insisting on change and real change, not just a lot of arguing among politicians. One article I saw that you wrote that I thought was quite interesting was called "A Million Animal and Plant Species Are Threatened with Extinction," about a report just showing how we have an unprecedented decline in animal and plant species. So it seems to me that what's interesting about that, to me, is that you have all this controversy over whether we really have global warming or whether it's really about carbon emissions, et cetera. But nobody can dispute the fact that that animal and plant species are threatened, seriously threatened, and that the oceans are polluted and that they're killing off all sorts of things like coral and things in the ocean. Anyway, so we have all these radical things going on. So the hopeful part of it is that we may actually see some change here. We may actually see change in systems. That the 2008 crisis demonstrated that our banking system isn't working, our financial system isn't working. We need a new system. So I just, you know, that was the book I've just finished called Banking on the People. It's basically about how the old system isn't working. It can't work. It's not sustainable. And we need a new system. And then I proposed what the new system would be. But back to your writings. So you've also written some interesting stuff about Ecuador, which is similar to Venezuela, where there was a Bolivarian revolution going on. They had a new constitution. This is under President Correa, where they respected the indigenous and the earth, and now they have Moreno, who is going the other way and is back to. So what happened there? How did the populist or the Bolivarian revolution get killed?
Oh, indeed, Ellen. Can I just make a comment about your last topic about killing off the species of the world? It's just no question. I mean, we're polluting the air, the water, the soil. I don't believe there's any food that's fit to eat anymore, even organic food, when the stuff like GMOs get into the atmosphere. Just like radiation can move from one country to another. You can detonate a nuclear bomb in one place, and a country maybe 1,000, 2,000 miles away can get the fallout from this stuff. The earthquake in Japan a decade ago that devastated, what was the name of the place? I forget the damn place where it happened. But it polluted the ocean. The stuff literally crosses the ocean. It reaches the west coast of the U.S. It reaches other places. So the fish we eat is unsafe to eat. The stuff gets into the atmosphere, comes down in rain, pollutes the ground. Every time I take a bite of food, Ellen, I feel I'm putting a toxin into my body. Besides the drugs that I may have to take, thankfully not too many because of health issues, but those are toxins. But to have toxins in the food that we eat and on the inability to have food that's safe, that maybe 100 years ago was much safer than the way it is now. Where the heck is this heading? I mean, if we're killing off all these species, we're heading toward killing off ourselves if we don't find a way to stop this thing. The problem is the power of money speaks, and as long as the profit motive dominates everything else, heaven knows, maybe we will end up killing ourselves. Ecuador under Rafael Correa was a bit like a Venezuela, a leader in a nation that wanted to use the nation's resources, also an oil country, not quite as dominant in oil as Venezuela, but oil, a big commodity for Ecuador, and Korea wanted to use the country's resources to provide benefits for ordinary people. This has all changed under Moreno, although I wrote about it. I wrote about his campaign, and he campaigned basically on the same thing that Korea stood for. Until he got into office and was bought out, either bribed or bullied or whatever, to go along with the U.S. system. So now he's a closet neocon going along with the U.S. policies. And, of course, we know what he did to Julian Assange, got him thrown out of the Ecuadorian embassy, even though he's an Ecuadorian citizen, given citizenship by Korea. The whole episode was a lawless act, and that's a separate issue altogether, war on free speech, speech, media, and academic freedoms. But Ecuador has gone the wrong way. Brazil had an election, went the wrong way, electing a fascist. Same thing in Argentina. Just one country after another. It looks like Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua are the only last ones standing, nations that want to help their own people, as well as their ordinary people, along with everybody else. But all the other countries in Latin America, their country serving their privileged people, the same way it works in Western societies. Well, there's a bad ending to this story, Ellen, besides all the wars going on.
And if you think of like Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, where he explained that they take behind the scenes, what they do is they say, you know, your choices are get killed. You know, either we bump you off or you go along with us and we make you very rich. And so, I mean, they do that routinely, apparently, in Latin America. So you wonder if that isn't what happened to Moreno as well. And I guess even Correa turned some at the end. So I've heard. I mean, people were disappointed in it. I'm not exactly sure why.
Correa and Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, they weren't perfect socialists as somebody idealistically might conceive of socialism. They definitely were business friendly, but they used the nation's resources for all the people in the country, not just the privileged ones. I remember in an article I wrote years ago, Ellen, in Venezuela, making a comment when the economy was going strong, everything was fairly normal, and I quoted the banking community saying they were having a party. They used the expression, they were having a party in Venezuela because they were making so much money. So even though the people in Washington were upset about Chavez and wanted to get rid of him, as far as the bankers were concerned and other industry that were doing well in the country, they were doing fine. They didn't mind. So let Chavez give away the resources to the Venezuelan people because they were making profits, they were doing well, and that's all they cared about. But that's changed drastically in the last few years, especially with low oil prices. Low oil prices has been the bane of the Venezuelan economy, along with all else that's going on.
And then you've written about how Julian Assange was turned over by the Ecuadorian government in return for an IMF loan.
Oh, yeah, that part of the bribery to Moreno, getting an IMF loan, maybe other benefits, maybe a nice fat bank account and a tax haven, who knows. He was accused of some kind of fraudulent activity that he vehemently denied, and I don't know whether it's true or false. Probably something that would be very, very corrupt in his administration if it's true, and there may be some truth to it. But this is the way the U.S. always works, to try to win somebody over. The way Perkins explained it, I mean, they can either bribe a bully or do something to them to get them to come along, and usually they do. It has not worked in Venezuela, not under Chavez, not with Maduro, and that's the reason all this stuff is going on. It has not worked in Iran, has not worked in Cuba for nearly 60 years, hasn't worked in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas, and these are the reasons these countries are on the U.S. target list for regime change. Hopefully there'll be no war. I don't think there'll be a war with these countries, Ellen. There could be a war because sometimes things happen by accidents, not necessarily by design. So there could be a war with Venezuela, Iran, even Cuba. My goodness. I remember quoting Jack Kennedy long, long ago, saying that he couldn't believe he ever got suckered into the Bay of Pigs. That began the plot began during the Eisenhower administration, and he picked it up when he was elected president. And he called it one of the dumbest things he ever did as president. He never would go along with doing it again. So it never happened again. But it could happen now, something a lot worse than the Bay of Pigs. But there could be a war against these independent countries Cuba is one thing, but attacking Venezuela, attacking Iran, would be two quagmires in different hemispheres. The Venezuelan people, there are millions of Venezuelan people that are armed and protecting their local communities. If the country is attacked, they could go to the hills. I'm talking about millions of people. They could go to the hills and wage a guerrilla war that could go on as long as the Afghan war. As far as Iran goes, it's far more powerful militarily than Yemen or Iraq or Syria. And if there's a war against Iran, which the Pentagon does not want because they know they would take some big hits if a war was waged, that could be the same thing, another quagmire. A Vietnam in the Middle East, if there's a war against Iran, it won't be one, and it won't be one against Venezuela, but it still could happen.
I agree that the intent is not really to go to war. The intent is to threaten war and to extort concession.
I think when Trump came into office, he's a businessman. I think what he really wanted in his heart of hearts was to do business with countries like Russia and Iran and everybody else to make money. Businessmen are interested in profits and making money and seeing their businesses profit. So he has the mentality of a businessman. I was nothing like him, but I was in small business most of my working life. So I understand that. If you don't make profits, the business dies and you go find another line of work. So that was my dominant aim, to see that the business was profitable so we stayed alive. I think he really would prefer this. But Vladimir Putin, of all people, explained the way the U.S. system works when a new president comes into office, and he said something to the effect that when he comes into office, people, men, whatever, in black suits show up, just like the one I'm wearing, he said, with briefcases, and they explain the facts of life to the new president. This is the way the system works. This is what you'll do. And if you don't do it, well, you may not be around very long. And it's true. Jack Kennedy went against the grain. We know what happened to him. The lesson has not been lost on his successes. So you either go along with the system or you may not be president very long. So I think Trump got that explained to him. I remember something about Clinton when he became president. The way the bond market, you need to please the bond vigilantes if you're going to make it as U.S. president. And he didn't understand it at the beginning, but he's a guy, and he figured it out very fast. So he realized this is the way you have to play the game. Same thing with Trump, same thing with Obama, Bush, Cheney, whatever. You play the game or you're not around very long. I think in his heart of hearts, he wanted something different than the course that he's following as president, but he had no choice.
Yeah, I agree. And that's not just speculation. That's what John Perkins wrote about in Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I mean, he was one of the hitmen that actually went in and said, "We hope you'll go along with us because otherwise you're going to get assassinated."
Either assassinated or impeached. Well, Nixon went against the grain.
Yeah, Nixon actually, for a Republican, I mean, he had a lot of really socialist projects going on.
Oh, he did. Look at what he did against the grain. He ended the war in Vietnam after escalating it, of course, but he ended it. His social programs, he was an environmentalist. He did things that the establishment did not like. So that was the whole business behind Watergate. It was a hoax. He never should have been forced to resign. And if he didn't resign, he would have been impeached. He didn't want to be impeached, so he resigned.
Yeah, another thing he did was he was proposing to set up an alternative banking system that would have been on the lines of a public banking system. I wrote about that a while back.
Because communist China, quote unquote, he opened up China, and that went against the grain of maybe the incipient neocons of the day.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Well, and speaking of China, so that's the last point I wanted to hit. You've written about the trade wars and blacklisting Huawei and its affiliates and how we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot with all that.
Oh, it's a real big issue. It's as big as anything else going on geopolitically. I think the so-called trade war is a lot less about trade, Ellen, than it is about wanting to undermine China's aim to become an economic, industrial, and technological powerhouse, especially the latter. And I mean, China is heading for being the world's largest economy one day on what's called a purchase price basis, what a basket of goods costs in the U.S. versus China. It already is the world's largest economy, but on a GDP basis, it's got a long ways to go. But it's on a it's on a track growing much faster than the U.S., so maybe in a decade or two or three, whatever, it will be the world's largest economy the way it's going. It's making great strides technologically, financially. It will be the dominant country in these areas one day, and the reason for the so-called trade war with China is to undermine these things from happening, and the trade deficit is a minor issue by comparison. So the whole idea is wanting China marginalized and isolated and undermined and contained. The same thing going on against Russia. That's what the trade war is really all about. And it worked against Japan in the 1980s. Something similar was done with Japan, and Japan succumbed to U.S. pressure. China is not Japan, and China will not succumb the way Japan did. And look what happened to Japan. 3 decades of stagnation following the 1980s because it went along with the U.S. system during the Reagan-Bush era. Well, China knows the lesson of Japan, and it will not go along. It will not make the same mistakes that Japan made, and that's what's bugging the Trump people. They can have as many rounds of trade talks as they want. They'll get China to compromise on some things, but it will not sacrifice its long-term aims. And Xi Jinping, the president of China, some days ago, in a speech that he made, said, China is going on a long march again. What happened in the 1930s for a couple of years, communist China besting nationalist China. So there's an economic long march going on that he's behind. And all of the ruling authorities are behind this, refusing to surrender to the U.S. on giving up its long-term economic and industrial and technological aims. It won't do it. So what's going to happen as a result? Good Lord, I don't know what's going to happen, Ellen, but possibly anything could happen, even war by mistake.
And I think the Chinese are probably more willing to sacrifice than we are. I mean, they're more willing to hold out. I've read that one edge they have on us is that they produce 90% of rare earths, which are necessary for various high-tech products like cell phones. So, I mean, they could really hurt us, even just in individual markets. So we, the people, are going to suffer while we have this power struggle going on, and their people as well.
Indeed. America's industrial base was relocated from the U.S. to China and other low-wage countries. These companies are important for China's economy, so it doesn't want to stifle the business that they do, but they can obstruct it in a lot of ways. They can have customs delays. They can do all kinds of things that make it very onerous for U.S. companies to do business, not so much that they might want to leave China. They can move to other countries, but some of the same stuff could happen to them. But China can strike back at the U.S. in a number of ways. China imports from the U.S., I forget the exact numbers, it'd be $120 or $30 billion annually, and it's about maybe $350 billion, maybe $400 billion that China exports to the U.S. So the trade deficit is huge between the two countries. But that really isn't the issue. It's a minor issue. This has been going on for decades, and only the Trump people have been making a big issue out of it. But the real issue is wanting to undermine China's growth, its aims to become a powerhouse country. That's the real issue. And there's also a military side of it as well. China is strong militarily. It's a nuclear power. There's a lot of U.S. provocations in the South China Sea that China is very upset about. Something could happen that there could be a confrontation accidentally over that. I don't know what's going to happen again, Ellen, but the saber rattling and the disputes that's going on between the two countries and the same thing going on with Russia, it's very possible we could see a war between these countries. And with nuclear powers, if there's a war, there's a very good chance these weapons will be used. The founder of America's nuclear navy, Hyman Rickover, once said in the 1980s in testimony to Congress, when nations go to war with each other, they will use whatever weapons they have in their arsenal to win if they have to. So if nuclear-armed nations go to war with each other, if it takes using these weapons to win, they'll use them. And if that happens, we're all doomed. Literally, we're all doomed.
Yeah, we have this big war economy going on. I mean, they need war. They need an enemy. So they need to have the appearance of an enemy, but like you say, nobody really wants to get obliterated with nuclear weapons. Very dangerous game. All right, well, I think you're doing marvelously well, and you've done great work. Do you want to say where people can find your writing?
All my articles are on my website, stephenlendman.org, Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. I put up articles every day as long as I'm well.
Yes, well, so great talking to you.
Ellen, it was great. I always enjoy being on with you.
Thank you very much.
We have a lot to learn about the depth of the impact that the Bank of North Dakota has had on that state over the past 100 years, so we get value from hearing about the ways in which this publicly owned bank accommodated the needs and potentials of that changing, growing, and challenged community. You'll appreciate that we're making good use of the 100th anniversary of the Bank of North Dakota by looking back through an historical lens at the miracle of populist organizing and practical planning, which is now the focus of a national movement to replicate its success. The Bank of North Dakota demonstrates that banking owned by and for the people of a region can be a powerful agency for protection and stimulation of common needs and goals. North Dakota is not an easy place to make a living, whether in farming or other land-based enterprises that rely on the environment and interpersonal community dependencies. North Dakotans have survived floods, freezes, and some frauds, and given us an inspiring example of how folks can work together to adapt and to thrive. Among those unique aspects are some of the laws they've created to protect their economic resources from the overpowering impacts of outside capital interests, such as Wall Street banks, monopolistic industries, and agricultural giants. Today, we continue our discussion with Mike Jacobs, an historian and author of the Bank of North Dakota's centenary book, The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, the First 100 Years. And we'll talk with Mike about how the bank moved through these challenges. One method of protecting their resources and retaining local control of farm production involves limiting financial abrogation and control to corporations in order to keep things local and within local control. One method is the anti-corporation farming legislation, which started in the 30s and continues to this day. Mike Jacobs tells us how and why an almost familial culture dominates local sensibilities. It helps explain how the bank is able to take personal concern for its clients.
Anti-corporation farming law was the political expression of it in North Dakota. The state forbid unrelated persons from organizing a corporation to farm in the state. And it was passed in spring of 1932 after the league itself, the first league, sort of collapsed and the farm economy in many ways went to hell. The 20s were very difficult in North Dakota. But that was an economic issue. And then, of course, in the early 30s, the drought struck, and things went from really bad to unimaginable. And the response was a new radicalization of North Dakota politics. The 1932 election season, there were three separate elections in 1932, including a presidential primary in the early spring. And then the primary election in June, at which a group of bills sponsored by the North Dakota Farmers Union and backed by Bill Langer, whose name you'll remember from the early story of the league, which sought to revise farm lending laws, farm bankruptcy laws. They called for a moratorium on farm debt. There were a number of those. Those did not pass. Langer was elected governor in the fall and implemented them through executive orders. But the anti-corporation farming law did pass, and that's become a continuing controversy in North Dakota. There have been, I think, it's been on the ballot three or four times over the last 90 years, and it was an issue again in the 2019 legislature. So got me thinking about how those issues sort of continue to recur. It certainly is a living issue in North Dakota. The most recent iteration of this arose in the 2015 session when lawmakers moved to amend the anti-corporation farming law to allow hog and dairy producers, basically feedlot operators, to incorporate and to own land. And that was opposed on two levels. One was communities that didn't want these facilities forced upon them, so to speak, and a growing, for lack of a better term, religious alliance with animal rights organizations and with anti-industrial farming organizations. This is not new. It's sort of focused on this particular area. So in 2015, the legislature passed this revision, and it was referred. Of course, North Dakota, as we've discussed previously, has a strong tradition of direct democracy. And so the revisions to the anti-corporation farming law were referred and rejected by wide margins in every county of the state. The majority against the revisions was nowhere less than 70%, not in any county in the state. But at the same time, the people who voted for the revisions were, by and large, reelected to the legislature. So the issue remains really potent when it is presented in the up or down terms, but when it did not become an issue in the actual legislative races where those decisions would be made. The legislature would make decisions about whether or not additional changes ought to be offered. So that was 2015, and now we're into the 2019 session. It takes 4 years for this whole thing to roll through the political system because we elect legislators to four-year terms and stagger them so that half are elected in presidential years and half in off years. So in 2019, the most recent session, additional changes were offered that would expand the definition of what constitutes a family. This is an interesting development because essentially the legislature agreed to changes that would allow persons related as second cousins to incorporate together to form a corporation that would be allowed to own land under the family farming exemption to the corporation farming law. And that was passed. Now we'll see whether or not that change, that broadening of the definition of family, will stand the test on the ballot if somebody chooses to refer it. It wasn't the kind of lightning bolt issue that the expansion of the exemption for animal confinement agriculture. That got big pushback. And that continues. Every time a hog feeding operation, a finishing operation is suggested, there's a big pushback. The current one is near Devil's Lake, a freshwater lake, and basically the opponents of the farm are saying, you know, the choice is farming or fishing, farming or freshwater, and a very tough pushback against that farm, which is owned by individuals. They're not incorporated, to my knowledge. But the other issue that has now arisen is the question of whether or not the state has the authority to permit these kinds of operations, or whether that is a function of local authorities. So those kinds of issues continue to churn in the state. The interesting thing, of course, about increasing the degree or lessening the degree of consanguinity is that we have gotten to the point now in North Dakota where we're not talking about fathers and sons or fathers and children, but we're talking about the third or fourth generation. So we're getting to grandparents and grandnieces and nephews who would be second cousins. So it's a testimony to the passage of time.
You're describing a landscape of very personal relationships.
Yes.
In a state that is using agribusiness, the financing for that might very well come out of New York, Wall Street banks, large financial institutions, whereas in North Dakota, 100% of the agricultural lending, that the agricultural lending, which was a primary part of the bank's portfolio, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
It's going to the people, going directly into some sort or some sense of family responsibility.
Yes, that would be true. The core of the argument in favor of the revisions to the corporation farming law, of course, is that incorporation is a way to spread risk. So if you have a corporate structure, the chance of a catastrophic credit failure would be less because the debt would be distributed among a larger number of entities, some of which would be very large, so that a debt on a quarter section of land in Grand Forks County would be almost immaterial. The trouble, of course, is that well-run corporations mind their debt, and if they have non-producing assets, they tend to shed. So potentially, at least the critics of this system would say, it leads potentially to instability. And that's the big problem, of course, that the bank had to confront in the 1930s when there was essentially a complete collapse in the rural credit system. And so the solution to the credit problem was addressed through centralized banking on the state level. And over the years, that has proven to be successful because the bank has been in a position to extend freer credit, shall we say, less expensive credit, to individual borrowers, often in cooperation with local private banks. That continues to be one of the bank's major lines of business, agricultural lending. Certainly the bank has diversified well beyond its original charter really was to do something about the agricultural credit crisis that was looming on the Great Plains and in North Dakota specifically. And of course, we know how that turned out. It got worse and worse and worse. And finally, the state ended up owning a fair amount of land and a very large amount of mineral acreage because, as we discussed earlier, the bank accepted mineral acres. Well, it actually kept mineral acres on the land that it acquired through mortgage foreclosures. It was, from the point of view of a banker, a private banker in 1938, that would seem reckless because there was no real value in the mineral acres. It was all basically gut feeling, really, that people had that mineral acres were going to be worth something someday. And as it turns out, of course, North Dakota is now among the wealthiest per capita in the country because of that decision by the state in the late 1930s, when it saw a need to at least behave like it was a real bank. That is, that it was really demanding credit rather than just extending loans without any expectation of their creditworthiness.
So it was in 1951, you say in the book, that oil royalty money began flowing into the bank.
Right. There's an arresting picture in the book of the first mineral auction. At the time, the state was auctioning the right to develop mineral acres, in other words, to put a well on a specific section of land. That function has since been moved to the state land board. But a very large part of the mineral assets of the state, that is the mineral acreage that the state owns, some of it is from the Enabling Act, which reserved two sections in every township to the state, but a very large percentage of it is from the loan program of the 1930s when the bank retained mineral rights.
That's Mike Jacobs. In our next conversation with Mike, we're going to hear how the oil boom in North Dakota affected the state's economy and the role that the bank has played in supporting new economic prospects. In looking back at the 100-year history of the Bank of North Dakota, we can see how integral the bank has been in actually saving the farms and families of North Dakota, despite great adversities over those many years, and how versatile it has been in addressing the credit needs of its citizens in the worst of circumstances. You'll find the whole story of this remarkable miracle on the prairie in the centenary retrospective book called The Bank of North Dakota, From Surviving to Thriving, The First 100 Years, authored by our guest, Mike Jacobs. You'll find the book illustrated and available on the Bank of North Dakota website, through your local bookstore or through online retailers. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.